welcome to The Garden Show. I'm Molly Kabler.
And I'm Kitty Lamonti.
And we are delighted to be here in the studio. This is the call-in version. We're live here at Raven Radio, KCAW in Sitka. It's just after 10:30. We would love to talk to you on the phone, if possible. 747-5877 is the number. We're going to talk today about pests, weeds, fertilizing, and answer a few specific questions that have come in.
But first, before we start on the, it sounds like the little pocketbook of horrors out there. If you haven't looked at the rhododendrons in the last week or two or three, they are so impressive right now. So, you know, even if you're not into gardening, the incredible displays that are happening right now on various streets in town and various yards are just super impressive. So, yeah.
We're having a great rhododendron year.
Oh my gosh, they're so gorgeous. And they can get so huge here, and they are so happy here. And really, Southeast Alaska and Sitka's about as far north as it goes are where the rhododendrons are super happy. I mean, people in Juneau kind of struggle a little bit with them. So just like bask in the glory of rhododendrons. And if all, you know, if you're like wondering what shrub to plant that gives you like green leaves in the winter and a great bloom, well, it's a rhododendron.
And they come in many shapes and sizes. While they're not necessarily thought of as a plant to prune, they are amenable to a certain amount of shaping. And members of my family in particular think a hard prune is a way to
wow.
do good work with a rhododendron. And with the right rhododendron, it does work.
Yes.
I don't always advise it. But.
Yeah, so it's kind of funny. It's like, and I know we were going to talk about pests, and we were going to move on to that, but really, when they say they give the size estimates for rhododendrons, believe them and add something. Because my Vulcan, which is supposed to be like 6x6, is probably like 12x6. I mean, it's a big plant and it's super happy. And the other one in the side yard that was supposed to be big is like, it's pretty much eating the entire side yard. So it might be like, I'm guessing it's probably 12 feet tall and probably easily that wide. And it's covered with these beautiful purple blooms. So it's well worth the space if you have it. There are a lot of other smaller ones, too. So you don't have to go for like the, okay, how big can my rhododendron get? Can I live in a rhododendron forest?
I think one of the limiting factors in places that have less moisture than we do is moisture. So
yeah.
The rhododendrons do fine, but they... it's not optimum. And here, I think we have just the optimum level
gorgeous.
Of moisture, rain, precipitation, humidity, all of those things that make the rhododendrons that, you know, are projected to be a certain size actually turn out to be bigger
right.
and better.
Right. Mega things. So if you don't have one, I don't know why you don't. You can even get a little one to put in a pot on your deck. But if there's really no space, if I'm really just, you're like, wait, Kitty, I just can't do this, just wander around town and enjoy them. And while you're at it, take a big sniff of the yellow azalea type of rhododendron that's at the Pioneer Home, because it is being lovely fragrant right now.
It's right by the steps when you are walking up toward the front door, right by the prospector.
Mm-hmm. I love walking through town and like sniffing things. It's like lilacs were on, the Matronalis, the Hesperus, it has another name.
Rocket.
Rocket, that smells good. The azalea smells good. It's like, ooh, just like follow your nose and pretty soon it'll be roses.
That yellow azalea, though, I think is the magic at the moment. In fact, I walked
mm-hmm.
by there and smelled it myself this week. So
mm-hmm.
I recommend it.
It's fun. We could have the sniffing tour of Sitka. Okay, so now to the bad and ugly.
I don't know if it's bad and ugly, but it's definitely challenging and process. I was thinking about that this week. I'm battling aphids, and you said there were others who wanted to hear about battling aphids. And I think the way I look at it is aphids keep me deeply in touch with my plants, literally and figuratively. So I don't like to use chemical sprays on my plants, but I find if it's in a garden plant, a shoot of strong water, some good water pressure just knocking the aphids back is often enough for the plant to make it, even though there's aphids around. The other thing is if it's deck plants, pots, or whatever, maybe not in your house, but and you see the little spiders around, those little spiders are your friends. So let maybe. Them be because they're eating aphids too. But, you know, removing the aphids themselves are probably the best bet. And you can get ahead of an aphid infestation on a plant with diligence.
Right. I think the main trick, and it's the same advice for probably any pest or for anything, is you need to be out looking at things in your garden. I mean, that's really the only way to know what's going on and to stop things early. And early is usually your best option if you can stop it. I like to squish aphids personally. It's evil, but you know, you can just run your hands down the stem, and it's not, you know, it's not, I actually like insects, so I don't want to sound too nasty here, but, aphids are problematic. I mean, they're one of those sucking insects that you know, they're pulling sap out of your plants or they're pulling energy, but they're also wonderful at transmitting viruses. And I've seen that actually in a few of my columbines, not all of them, but a few of them end up with these weird kind of viral infections that cause the flowers not to develop. So,
right, misshapen, miscolored flowers.
They're really...
Yeah. And if you have that, by the way, we're actually talking about the aphids, but if you see that in your columbines, you want to take those plants out and burn them or put them in trash because you don't want that transmitted by other pests.
No, it's going to go. I have one plant that's going to go into the fire. Most of them look pretty good, but that is the best way to dispose of a plant that's infected with something. Is do not compost it. Do not just throw it off to the side yard. Do not throw it in your neighbor's yard. Either if you don't have access to a burn pile, I would suggest bagging it and putting it in the city garbage.
Yeah. So you can do the same with aphids to a certain degree if you have a single plant or a couple plants that are deeply aphid infested. Just removing those plants will save you from that being spread across your whole garden or your whole set of boxes or pots or whatever.
Or your greenhouse.
Yeah. Or if it's just starting, you can often see, I mean, they're pretty, you can see them.
Oh,
they're
yeah.
located right in the little margins of the leaves and the flowers and the stems, and sometimes some strategic pinching off of those areas and then a good sharp wash. If you really want to get intense at my level of intensity, which does not mean pesticides, that's another option. I'm not saying you can't. You sure can. Just some soapy water. And I mean soap, not detergent. So like an Ivory type soapy water and then a rinse, that can help too.
And not very much so in the water. The
like so, dishwater.
Like
type.
Dishwater.
Like you'd wash your dishes.
Yes, at the beach. I'm still thinking light. The other thing that I like to use, and it's the next level up, but it still is not a general. It's not actually a pesticide. It's not a toxin. Are the horticultural oils, they're ultralight oils. So you can spray them right on a plant that's so infested you just can't deal with it, or if it's in a spot that you're concerned that you're just not going to get all of them. Greenhouses is one spot where it might be useful. Houseplants sometimes. I had to drag my lemon outside and spray it because I couldn't keep up with it by hand. So it had all sorts of ugly things. But what horticultural oil does, it's ultralight oil and it smothers the insect. Not pretty idea, but you're going to squish them or something otherwise. So that's my, like, okay, when I can't keep up with it with water, soapy water, or squishing, I move on to smothering.
So one of the pests that's really seems a bit more rampant that we're hearing about are on the currant plants.
Uh-huh.
So let's talk about that. So what is it that's taken out the currant plants right now, or their leaves anyway?
It seems to be sawflies, and mostly sawfly larvae that are eating the leaves, and they can defoliate your plant. I was talking to someone last night who went out to look at her currant, and there were no leaves left, like zero leaves left. And I talked to someone else who was diligently going out, and when they found larvae, squishing them. I've been like staring at my black currant, and you know, it's probably useless, but I still sprayed it with horticultural oil because I had it in my hand and I was checking all the leaves and I didn't see any larvae, but I was like, okay, fine. You might be small. I might not be seeing you. Last summer, the sawflies decimated the native, we call them stink currants, that are gray currants, the Ribes bracteosum. Mm-hmm.
Those big, really odoriferous ones.
Yes, and there are lots of places in town where I did not see a single leaf that hadn't been eaten. So these guys are kind of serious. And it's not like, you know, one season's leaf loss won't, you know, probably kill a plant. But if it keeps happening year after year, that plant can't sustain itself. It's just not going to be able to. So you need to do something. Diligence, spraying, squishing. You know, if the one type of plant-based pesticide is the pyrethrum-based. Now, that doesn't mean just because it's plants-based that it's, like, not toxic and safe. It's a general killer. So that is, like, to me, is like an item of last resort, because you will kill all the good guys, bad guys, pollinators, whatever, you will kill them. But so I would try to stick with the other methods first. You can use soap, you can use squishing. If you have any leaves that have the larvae on them, you want to, if you can't remove the larvae, remove the leaf. And again, put it in the garbage or burn it. Any leaves that fall down below, put them, you know, clean up. This is a big sanitation issue.
So with any pest, there's a balance to it. There are other insects and predators that are, you know, in hopes, in balance, helping with that. And one of the things to keep in mind is when you use a broader spectrum pesticide is you're killing all of those. And then if your sawfly larva or whatever else you're trying to manage get back in, you don't have any of the rest of the balancing insects that, you know, or predators or birds or whatever. So that's one of the reasons why we're cautious about this in terms of using a more broad spectrum pesticide to try and resolve a single infestation. And by single, I mean a single organism's infestation. It's also good to know what are the things that you should let remain in your garden. So I know the black stink beetles that we see in and around the edges of our garden are a little creepy crawly, and you may not enjoy them, but do know that those are your friends. They are predators that are eating the small slugs and I don't know what else. So when you see those black stink beetles, they emit an odor if you really disturb them. Those are your friends and you want to let them stick around. And then, oddly enough, that's the spiders. I mentioned that before.
Especially the real spiders, yeah.
As much as you can tolerate spiders in the right places, they're also your friends.
Yes, so leave those guys alone. So I did want to share a website. So if you have a pest or you have a problem on a plant and you can get a photo of it, there is actually through the Alaska Cooperative Extension and the Integrated Pest Management Program, there is a pest reporter. And you can submit questions and photos directly to this website. And it's pestreporter.alaska.edu. And if that went by too fast, we'll try and get that posted. But you can also just Google Integrated Pest Management Program Alaska, and you look for the citizen science self-reporting thing. And that's a good way to get kind of more, like, okay, this is exactly what my pest is. Because you need to know in order to treat it successfully. I mean, you can squish anything, but it's nice to know really what you're dealing with. Maybe you don't need to worry about that insect at all.
Right. And sometimes it's something that comes in a phase. I have a little small black insect. This is a little embarrassing. I don't know what it is, but it runs it through a cycle, and every year it's like all of a sudden I have them everywhere and I've lived with them. They're like almost like a thrip. They're really small and they'll run through and I'm like, oh, here they are, and then they're gone again. So there's some sort of cycle that they're working, and to know what they are or to recognize that they're actually not going to ruin your plants in any long-term fashion. It's just as well, because they're no doubt feeding somebody out there.
Right.
The birds, maybe.
Right, yes. So encourage the birds in your yard, too. They are wonderful. I see the sparrows and all those thrushes kind of working the yard, so I am super happy to have them on my team. I don't have a cat, and I actually don't even have a dog. So I have nothing that's disturbing my bug eaters, insect eaters, I should say. So diligence, identification, squishing. I guess that's my thing.
You know, you and here's the thing. Weeds are the same. It's it's sort of the same principle around weeds. And this is the time of year I find that I'm really paying attention to weeds. Now, we do a bunch of weeding at the beginning of the year when we're sort of getting into the garden. And then we have all these beautifully cultivated places, either our perennial beds that are all cleaned up or our garden beds where we have planted starts and seeds. And right now, all of the weeds are super happy with that great culture of the garden bed that you've prepared for them, and they're going wild. So it's daunting to deal with weeds here. We have some classics, the buttercup, the running buttercup. You know, if you're a gardener, you know about those, and they're relentless. Some of the little chickweeds, those are the other ones that seed prodigiously, and they appear everywhere. Dandelions, of course, a little more easy to control, but still challenging. And then horsetails is another big one. If you have horsetails, you know how pernicious those guys are. I think horsetail is the embodiment of the word pernicious. And but the thing to know is that in small contained areas, it is possible to eliminate weeds. It requires the same idea as pest control, paying attention, and being diligent. And if you can get to them before they seed, and if you can get as much of the root out as possible, that will be what helps you. Hello, you're on the Garden Show.
How do you choose which rhododendron bough to prune? Any without blooms or any without leaves, or just the bottom ones, the lowest boughs? Thank you.
Great question. Thanks. Okay, so the question is, how do you choose which rhododendron boughs to prune? And the answer is, number one, you're in charge. So there's there's no big formula. I would recommend, if you have online resources, to take a look at, just Google it up. You'll get some idea of it. The other thing is, if you're shaping a plant, make a plan and plan to prune 3 years in a row to get to the shape that you want. They also, you don't want to prune before blooms because they set their buds the year before. So after rhododendrons bloom is the best time to prune. And don't prune more than a third of the plant. Right. You might get away with a haircut, but you might not.
Yeah.
And so really it depends on what you're trying to accomplish. Yeah. If you have one reaching for sun, think differently than pruning. Think about moving it. And if it's crushing other plants that you want to maintain, then that's an area or a side of a plant that you might want to prune.
Yeah, I have I have one rhododendron, like I said, that's like twice as big as I thought it was going to be. And it's kind of moving into the trail, the path basically to the rest of my garden. And I've been trying to go way under after it blooms, so I'll get the longest branches, but I'll try to go way back in the bush, so I'm not making an obvious cut that it will really show up. I'm just trying to like shrink it slowly, and I prefer to like prune a couple of branches and then walk away. I mean, I'm a big wimp when it comes to pruning, and then I'll come back and I'll like go, okay, that looks fine, I can do a little more, because it's like you can't put them back once they're gone. So I like the slow, you know, steady approach, and that seems to work for me. And the rhododendron is tolerated getting pruned. And there's a couple of directions it's growing that I'm going to actually move the plant that it's covering or starting to cover, because I'd rather have the rhododendron there. I mean, it's spectacular. And the other little plant can just kind of get moved. But, yeah, I think you want to decide what the problem is. If it's a branch that looks ugly, you can just get rid of it. I mean, I have one that kind of took it in the shorts once when it got moved. And I've been slowly reshaping it, trying to get it kind of back into something that looks nice. But I don't want to lose it because the flowers are just gorgeous. But, yeah, so I'm going to take my time, try to save it.
So by contrast, our Sitka rose, you can just pretty much cut anywhere and they recover no problem. And we tend to do the haircut style where we prune it back so that all the branches are roughly the same size. With a rhododendron, you're doing stem by stem, branch by branch, really is what I should say, and down toward the base of the plant with each of those will help the plant retain some of that natural gracefulness of the
forms are just
of the
gorgeous
plant.
When they have the space and they're in a happy spot, their forms are gorgeous. So you're really just trying to either keep it into the shape you want it or, yeah, mostly that's it for me is, like, trying to get it back. And when a plant suffered from something, you know, it's that kind of slow rehabilitation. That's what I'm going to call it. I have an azalea I'm rehabilitating and I have a rhododendron I'm rehabilitating. And it's worth the patience with the kind of semi-goofy looking shape in the meantime.
And so I guess maybe unless someone else has another question about rhododendrons, the last word on rhododendrons is they're going to bloom here. They're going to be beautiful. And in about 3 weeks is the ideal time to start fertilizing them, because by the 1st of August, right, many of them have set their buds for their bloom buds for the following year. So it's in our climate, they bloom, then they set a new round of leaves, and then they start setting their buds for next year's bloom. And so your ideal time to fertilize, you can look at your own rhododendrons and see it, is after those leaves have come out and just before they're setting buds, because they're going to go, oh, great, we've got all this fertilizer-rich environment.
Life
now they're
going to
set a great set of blooms for the following year. And again, we always say, read the package, don't over-fertilize. They're a little sensitive to being burnt.
Yep, that's a good sum up for rhododendrons, Molly. So weeds?
Weeds, yeah, we were talking about weeds.
Yeah, so the beast that I mostly kind of, I don't, you know, I have a lot of the little cresses or the cardamomes in my garden, but they're pretty easy to just, like, they seed a lot, but they're easy to kind of, like, quick remove. The weed that I do, like, I just know I'm just going to be dealing with for the rest of my natural life is the trailing buttercup. Mm-hmm. Once it got in there, I was like, oh, dear, I'm just going to have to be on it and just try to keep up with it and slow it down. And we will have a detente is what I'm kind of hoping. We will break even. I have avoided getting horsetail. I'm just like finding wood to knock on in my garden. And I've done that in a couple of deliberate ways. When I get plants from friends, I put them in a pot. I do not put them in my garden. And I see what happens. When I get soil from someplace, I put it in a separate pot. You know, not the, you know, bagged garden soil, but like the city was generously sharing the soil that it had built through compost. Well, I thought that was great, and I brought some home, believe it or not. But it's in a separate spot, you know, just in case. I mean, no one deliberately tries to give you weeds. It just happens. They're out there. So that's the easiest way to not have horsetail or buttercup is to avoid getting them in the first place.
Right.
Yay.
Oddly enough, you know, you think you'd never get rid of horsetail. I think you can get rid of horsetail more than you can get rid of the buttercups.
I think so, too.
And it just requires endlessly taking it out and either burning it or putting in your trash. Every piece of horsetail creates a new plant. That's why they're so evil and capable.
And successful.
And capable of being weeds. And so, what, you know, just... if you can know where they're growing in your bed and stay on them. Ultimately, you're sort of starving them out by pulling off the green because it's difficult to get out their roots.
Frighteningly, that doesn't work as well with buttercups, even though it should.
Yeah.
But you do. It's just, I mean, my I've gotten rid of them in some little spots, but you can't go away for the whole summer. And, you know, you've cleaned them up one summer and you go away the next summer and you're like, wait, why are these here? Because they were always there.
Yeah, they grow all winter in our climate under the ice and snow. It's amazing.
So they're very happy. I guess the only other thing, it's hard to call it a weed, but salmonberry is something I have to stay on top of. I mean, I just like, okay. And it's mostly the plants that we're talking about that are most of the real problems are things with underground stems. Mm-hmm. Hence my rant a few weeks ago on ground covers.
Right.
Because that's what they do. They cover territory by underground stems, whether they are a deer heart in the forest, salmonberry, horsetail, buttercups, you name it, that's one way they spread. And it's a super successful strategy for a plant and can make you cry if you're a gardener.
So we had a couple questions come in, and one was about growing basil indoors and outdoors in Sitka. And you know, why am I not having a good time with my basil? Part of the reason is that basil does not grow here outdoors unless it's a very protected environment. It would have to be up against a very warm and protected place, or it'll need to be inside some sort of a cloche or some sort of a greenhouse. And then even then, our environment is so humid that they're really susceptible to molds, and aphids love them. There are many problems with basil. Now, growing basil is glorious, and if you want to do it, your best bet is inside in a windowsill.
Right. I agree. I have some in the greenhouse, but I watch them. I'm like, they feel like my most fragile plant that I grow. Tomatoes, whatever. Tomatoes are fine. You give them some dry and some warm, and they are cool. Basil, I'm like always like, okay, are you going to behave yourself? Yeah. So I think greenhouse or in the house, keep your eyes on them.
Yeah, they need a lot of consistency.
Yeah.
They need consistent moisture and consistent warm. And then pinching, they do
right.
well if you pinch them back. And once they're sort of ailing, you're not going to really
just
revitalize them. They're an annual for the most part, and they won't have a lot of oomph to get there. Now, if you get that one basil plant that's really going for it and it happens now and then, go ahead and keep that one going
right.
in your windowsill.
I kind of like to start them in waves, you know, start a few every now and again, every couple of weeks, and then you'll have plenty. Oh, and we only have just a few minutes left, and we know we had a question about rhubarb. What to do with rhubarb that's starting to not produce as much?
Right. So the big thing for rhubarb is it takes a lot of fertilizer and nutrition. So if your rhubarb is in decline, here's what I suggest you do. Take a sharp shovel, cut it in half, remove the half, even if you think, well, there's not that much there, and refill that hole where you're taking out those big, heavy roots that rhubarb has with something super nutritious.
Right. I think that's the big thing is dividing them and feeding them, and then they're usually fine. They like more sun here than people tend to think of rhubarb. I mean, my rhubarb's in full sun, and those are the plants that are doing great. I mean, I have other ones that are in kind of half light, and they're fine as well, but they like sun, they like food, and yep, they grow these massive, like, thigh-sized roots that, you know, you don't really need them to put quite that much oomph into the rhubarb roots. So, division. I've taken access to them in the past.
And we're running out of time, but the other thing I wanted to say is that this is the time of year to look around at your starts, and if they seem like they're suddenly not really growing anymore, you know, like they had a great start, they look healthy, but they just don't seem to be pumping, that means you need fertilizer
mm-hmm.
or nutrition. So look up side dressing, add bone meal or blood meal this time of year is a really good thing, or some sort of other organic
yeah.
side dressing fertilizer. You're adding something near the plant so those roots can get it right away. Spent coffee, composted grain, those are all good choices.
Yeah, I like to add, right once the plant's already in the garden, I like to kind of go with the bone meal, blood meal mix. Alfalfa meal is another one you can add to it, and then I'll put all those other things in my compost. Yeah, so I just did a big weed and feed in the vegetable garden, and things are looking pretty good, knock on wood. But yeah, that's what I did. I pulled all the weeds. I made sure they had water. I fed them, and hopefully they'll reward me.
Thanks for joining us on The Garden Show. If you have Garden Show questions, we're probably not going to be live on the air, but we'll try to, through social media, answer your questions and provide some more information if you specifically want to know about what to do in Southeast Alaska with your garden.
But in the end, I hope you enjoy your garden, whether you grow flowers or vegetables or both, and have a great time out there. It's a great way to get connected with nature.